little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Well, we've got a special guest special to us, and we'll tell you why.
We are podcasted. You can find the entire archive, 7 years of Thinking Clearly, on the World Wide Web at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's libsyn.com. Or just open up your favorite podcast app and search for Thinking Clearly. You'll find us there. For today's topic, we do have a return guest, and we're going to be talking about disinformation, its creators, amplifiers, and believers, and how to fight back for truth and protect democracy.
And our special guest is special to us on this edition of Thinking Clearly, philosopher, educator, and author Lee McIntyre. I do say special guest, special to us, because Lee is our first and only third-time guest on this show. And he holds a PhD in philosophy. He's currently a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. And he's authored numerous articles and essays and a plethora of books, including Post-Truth, The Scientific Attitude, How to Talk to a Science Denier, and his latest titled Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. Professor Lee McIntyre, once again, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you so much for having me, and again and again.
Well, thanks for coming back. We obviously really enjoy talking with you, and I'm really excited about this book that you have coming out. So I guess we'll just jump right into it. This book is describing your thoughts on how disinformation is, quote, now threatening the very fabric of our society. That's quite a statement. Maybe let's start with defining our terms. Can you review for us and our listeners the difference between misinformation and the topic of your book, disinformation?
I'm glad you asked that question because it's the most important one, and especially at the start. Misinformation is an accident. It's a mistake. It's when people believe something that doesn't happen to be true, but it's not something that was intentional. Disinformation is a lie. Disinformation is when somebody intended to convince somebody with false information that they should take it for true. And therein lies the crucial difference, because if you believe something that somebody else wants you to believe and it's false, then there's trouble, but also potentially a way to fight back.
Do you see a pattern in the progression of your thinking starting from your book, Respecting Truth, because you've stuck with this subject and seem to have worked it through in your own philosophical way? So do you see a progression in your thinking from that book to your latest book?
I love that question. And yes, I do. My son talks to me sometimes about, you know, why are you still writing on this same topic? You know, choose something else. And I did write a couple of novels in between just to to be interested in something else. But there are really two reasons. One is because every time I write a book, things seem to get worse. There's another aspect to the problem. And the other thing is that I keep thinking of things that are related. Let me tell you how they're related. I started off really interested in the social sciences. I wanted to make the social sciences better. I wanted to make them more scientific, more like natural science. And then I noticed that people were attacking natural science. So I started to write about that. And then once I started to write about defending science, then they started to attack reality and attack reality with some of the same tactics that the science deniers had used to attack science. And that's pretty much where we are now. So, I mean, my interest is, you know, anybody that looks at the titles of my last few books could imagine are in truth and belief and justification and warrant and denial and disinformation and what those mean. They're all related in a way. And I have to say that the most recent book is my shortest book. I think in some ways it might be my most important, because the last piece of the puzzle finally fell into place. Now, maybe I say that every time, but this time I really mean it. Because what I realized with On Disinformation is that all those years of being obsessed with the question of denial, I started to think about why people were deniers in the first place. And I realized it was because somebody wants them to be. They don't just wake up one day and they're deniers. They are fed disinformation, and that's what makes them deniers. And I also realized in a big way after January 6th that this was a threat not just to science, but to our grasp on reality. And if it's a threat to our grasp on reality, it's also a threat to democracy, because I'm one of those people who happen to think that truth and honesty are important in a democracy. So this book is really short. I mean, you can read it in about an hour. But I think it is in some ways the coda to all the other work. Not to say that you have to read the other ones to understand this, but there's some urgency to this book too, because we're just a little over a year away from an election that could decide some very big topics, like whether we continue to live in a democracy. And I wanted to write a book that was really a citizen's guide, something you could carry around in your pocket, something that was actionable, not just so that you'd understand the problem, but I wanted a book that would tell you, these are the steps that you can take if you care as much as I do about science and truth and democracy.
When I read the book, it's almost as if the emotional content was beginning to come up. The philosophical, let's talk about everything and let's weigh everything and let's define everything, let's analyze everything, had sort of moved to enough is enough. Let's begin to think about ways that we can do something about this situation. Am I catching the tone of the book?
You're right. I had one friend read it and say that this was not just public philosophy, this was advocacy. And I can live with that, because I think that I'm still a philosopher. I'll always be a philosopher. But it's important when you have studied something and you understand the stakes and it's about something that you care about, it's all right to advocate for the things that you care about when they're endangered. I think that's appropriate. And I think that there are a lot of people who agree with me too. You know, I didn't want to falsely hold back. And I see this in the media now all the time. I remember when CNN was in its most recent rebranding, you know, the new CEO said, well, you know, we're not going to be partisan anymore. We're just going to tell both sides of every story. And then I read on Twitter, a fellow that I didn't know before, but he's got a terrific book out. His name's Stuart Stevens. And he said something that I wish I'd said. How do you tell both sides of a lie?
And we're going to return to these themes a little bit. The idea, the difference between sort of trying to figure things out and being neutral and analytical and activism, doing something about it. We're going to return to that theme a little bit later in sure. our discussion. But I want to dig into your book a little bit here, because early in your book, you talk about the post-truth playbook. Can you describe that for us, and who is using that type of playbook currently?
The post-truth playbook, I mean, in my book, Post-Truth, I define that notion as the political subordination of reality. People who want something and they feel that they can get it by creating an army of deniers. Maybe it's a politician who doesn't like reality. They don't like what the economy is doing or what crime is doing, because it doesn't serve their political interests. Think of the cigarette companies in the 1950s when they didn't like the study that was going to show that smoking increased the risk of lung cancer. So the post-truth playbook is when someone figures out really what autocrats and authoritarians have known forever, which is that if you can control the information flow, you can control the belief and you can control the population. The post-truth playbook, I think I describe it in the book. I can't remember the passage exactly from heart, but you learn to lie, and you lie in such a way that you're not just causing the person to believe a falsehood, but you're polarizing them. You're making them hate and distrust the people who don't also believe that same falsehood. And I'll take it down even one more level to make it even scarier. The other thing that happens is you create people who are cynical. I mean, one thing that goes on in the post-truth era is people think, well, that truth is so hard to know. I mean, it might be out there, but how can I, you know, be my own fact checker? How can I possibly know the truth? Well, that's a very useful tool to the people who create disinformation, because what it means is, how can anybody be held accountable? How's there any blame? I mean, if there's no truth, then there's no blame. So you can see how these strands begin to come together. When somebody wants something and they think that it can be served by creating an army of deniers, they use disinformation to create denial. And that's the post-truth playbook.
I don't know if we want to name names, but who is currently playing by that playbook?
Let me see if I can think of just even one person. Look, it's no secret. You'll know from the first few pages in the book, because I open with January 6th. I think that Trump is a master propagandist. He is often dismissed as a clown and a buffoon. And I mean, in some ways he is, but he is a near genius level propagandist. And he really succeeded in something no other person had really done, which was the first successful domestic disinformation campaign, you know, in the United States. There are other folks like Vladimir Putin, but you want to trace that back to Vladimir Lenin. In the 1920s, just after the beginning of the Russian Revolution, was really the person who invented modern information warfare. He created the Cheka. He appointed Felix Dzerzhinsky, his first director of the Cheka. And they really started this idea of information as war. And that's what the Russians still do. And one really fascinating thing is that I don't think Trump reads much, but I think he knows that playbook. I think that if you watch Putin and you watch Trump, they use some of the same nameable disinformation tactics that go back 20 or 30 years in, you know, the Russian and even the Soviet era. So, you know, those are two names. Two of the biggest disinformers on the field today are Putin and Trump.
In that first chapter of your book, The Creators, reading that one almost gets the idea that this is a coordinated campaign of disinformation. So I'm wondering how much of it is really a coordinated campaign by these creators who are using this post-truth playbook versus being just sort of an artifact of the attention economy.
It's a good question. I mean, there are real conspiracies in the world. Look what the tobacco executives did in 1953 when they came together and brought in a public relations specialist to advise them to fight the science. I mean, that was a real conspiracy, and they kept that conspiracy together to, you know, doubt the truth about cigarette smoking and cancer for 40 years so they could continue to sell cigarettes. So it's a natural question to ask, is it always like that? I think that sometimes there's a genuine conspiracy. I think that sometimes it's just people rowing in the same direction. They both want the same outcome. Imagine a world in which Trump wanted to stay in office or wanted to be elected in the first place, and Putin thought that that was a good idea. They'd be rowing in the same direction, even if they weren't necessarily in a conspiracy together. Now, look, I have to say they might have been in a conspiracy together until we get the unredacted volume two of the Mueller report. We really don't know. You know, Trump waves that around as if somehow he were exonerated, and he monumentally confused between collusion and conspiracy. Conspiracy is the legal term. Maybe he's not confused. Maybe it's disinformation. But the point is that there was a lot of Russian disinformation in the 2016 election, and Trump didn't hate that. Whether that means that they were conspiring together, I don't know. But the problem is that even if they're just pulling in the same direction, you get weird synergies. For instance, one synergy you get is that Russian propaganda is fought very well by the United States Army, by our counterintelligence officials, until it's laundered through a domestic filter. So the minute Russian propaganda goes to Fox News or any other network, then it can't be touched. You know, by the Constitution, the United States Army is not allowed to target and, you know, fight back against news organizations. What does that lead to? Well, one thing that the Russian propagandists know is, well, let's make this as attractive as possible to right-wing media, you know, because then it's going to be laundered and then our job is amplified, right? So you'll often find them looking for things. In the 2016 campaign, the number one target for Russian disinformation were African-American voters. Now, they didn't think they were going to vote for Trump, but if you look at the propaganda, they didn't want them to vote at all. And then was that laundered through a domestic filter? Absolutely.
Yeah, you touched on this, but in your opinion, what is the role and the impact on disinformation, polarization, politicization of information in the politicized media? Like you had mentioned Fox News, but there's also, you know, CNBC. It seems that there's more and more kind of media being polarized in one direction or another. So, you know, obviously they're participants in this, and there are restraints, as you mentioned, but I'm kind of curious that overall kind of role and impact that they do play.
Obviously, partisan media is the most advantageous to a disinformer if they're, you know, pulling in the same direction. But the interesting thing to note is that even if someone is not partisan, even if they're not intending to, they can still amplify disinformation just by covering it. So the thing to imagine here is that disinformation is useless without it being amplified. I mean, the whole point of disinformation is to get it into as many ears as possible. You can do that even on networks that are not partisan, on networks that are hoping to be objective, on networks sometimes they have their own interests, like not wanting to be accused of political bias, and so they want to tell both sides of the story. Or maybe they are very interested in viewer engagement and conflict sells, and disinformation is very engaging. And here I'm going to morph over too to the social media companies, which are part of media, whether they like it or not. And they live or die by clicks, by engagement. They don't fight back as hard as they could against disinformation because they make money from it. That doesn't make them partisan. That makes them self-interested. But self-interest is sufficient to amplify disinformation. There was a brilliant psychologist, George Lakoff, who came up with this idea of the truth sandwich. If you're going to report on a lie, you first tell the truth, then you say the lie, and then you say what's true again. I mean, he's got a more subtle account than that. But the idea is that if you just start with the lie, which you see news organizations do, you know, is there alien life? News at 11, you know, they'll start with, you know, the teaser, the hook. That's not necessarily a lie, but you see my point, right? You start with a sensational claim and then maybe you debunk it later. It's too late.
So maybe media is falling into this role of, I love the way you describe it, rowing in the same direction, maybe not co-conspirators, yeah. But...
they don't even know they're rowing, though, is the thing. I mean, what I think of them more as like accomplices, you know, the bystanders, or maybe not even the bystanders, but the unwitting accomplices who don't realize that they're making the situation worse. I'll tell you, the journalist that I absolutely adore is Soledad O'Brien, because she said, stop booking liars on your program. You don't have to have both sides of every issue. You know, when NASA launches a rocket, you don't have a split screen with the flat earthers saying that didn't happen. You know, you don't need to do that for factual matters. If it's an opinion matter, political matter, go ahead. But if it's a factual matter, I mean, just today's a good example. Today's a perfect example. All over the news, every channel that I turned to back and forth was saying, the economy is getting better. Why don't voters believe it? And then they'll show the poll of all these voters who say that the economy is terrible. They don't trust Biden on the economy. They think the economy is going terribly. And, you know, that's within the context of the Wall Street Journal poll that shows Trump and Biden tied. And so Biden is trying to break through with the message that the economy is actually pretty good. Inflation is going down. The unemployment rate is, you know, still historic lows, lowest it's been for 50 years. But people don't feel it. Why don't they feel it? Because they're being lied to. All day, every day, the partisan media is telling them, oh, you know, inflation, boogeyman, you know, inflation is still high. And the nonpartisan media is talking about the issue. And, you know, I was just sitting there watching it today. I was having my lunch trying to imagine, what if they were talking about another factual issue and they kept polling people on their feelings? I mean, there's the Uniform Crime Report that tracks, you know, murder. Do they go out and take a poll to ask people whether murder's going up or down? No, they check the uniform crime report. They might ask people how they whether they feel safe, but they don't ask people whether the crime rate is going up or down. So why are they asking people whether the economy is good or bad? I mean, by objective measures from people, you know, experts on the economy is doing very well right now. Again, if they're asking people how they feel, that's legit, but it can still be misleading. And why do they do it? Because it's the, it feeds the beast. It's the narrative that all the media want. They all want the narrative of conflict, failure, and chaos. That is what keeps us glued to our set. That's why they, you know, sometimes I think they don't report the news, they drive the news. Is Biden too old? Is the economy failing? You know, these are these stories that people talk about on their own and then the news reports it, or do they see it on the news and then they talk about it?
So the media is catering to our partisan nature as human beings. I know there's at least two, and I can't remember the names of them, online news sources that attempted to create a market for news that showed both sides accurately. They fact-checked themselves. In other words, they weren't pandering to the emotions of one side or the other. They didn't introduce false equivalencies. And a false equivalency is introducing another side that really doesn't have any merit or support. But those didn't seem to take off. They didn't seem to really do well. Is there any hope for enough people to get to the point where that becomes their news source of choice?
If you think about the dopamine hit that people get when they watch the news from the perspective that they like, that's the channel that they're going to watch. I love to listen to the BBC. It's on NPR at home here at 10 a.m. on the radio, and I seem to be in the car around then. I listen to the BBC. And they cover American politics pretty well. It's shocking to listen to them, you know, how they cover American politics, because it's not a voice that you hear on the left or the right here in the United States. And it does seem to me to be more fact-based. I don't know how popular the BBC is amongst other American citizens. It's popular in my house because I listen to the BBC. It's pretty hard to get people interested in something that, you know, doesn't give them that dopamine hit, if that's what they want. We can get, we as viewers can get polarized. We can get addicted to the what's the latest outrage content.
We need to encourage the dopamine hit for people when they actually accurately assess reality.
Yeah, facts.
How do we do that?
That felt good. That was a fact. Ooh, there's another hit.
Exactly. Right. Well, as I alluded to it earlier, the tone of this book seems to me to be somewhat different than your others. And to me, it really sounds more like the voice of a passionate activist rather than a dispassionate philosophical inquirer. And we talked about that. My evidence in support of that is that I counted up the number of words times the word war or warfare.
Oh boy.
Regarding to disinformation appears, and I counted about 24 times in the book. So I could tell there was a different tone to the book from that. And we talked about your building sense of conviction, really, in regard to these issues. It brings us to this idea that I think about often, and that's the difference in thinking between sort of the theorist trying to figure out, or philosopher trying to figure out what reality is, what human nature is, what's best for human beings and our culture in the long run, and doing that in a thoughtful, analytical, evidence-based way. There's a difference between that kind of communication and the communication on a picket line or at a demonstration. You don't go into a demonstration pondering all the alternatives. You go in shouting the talking points of the group that you're trying to motivate.
Yes.
And I hear people when they're talking in that activist voice, and I'm arguing back in my mind with them, but yeah, there's this and that. So talk about that a little bit, the difference between that philosophical, thoughtful approach and that activist approach.
You put your finger on it before. The most important thing is to avoid false equivalents, because you don't want to succumb to the idea that in order to demonstrate your objectivity, you have to make things seem equal when they're not equal. As I said one time, a long time ago, the halfway point between the truth and a lie is still a lie, you know, and as Stuart Stevens said, you know, better, how do you tell both sides of a lie? You can't. But you raise a really important point, which is that even in the heat of the moment, even in advocacy, you have to make sure that you're still thinking clearly, because it's easy, no matter which side you're on, to get polarized by disinformation. Part of the goal of disinformation is not just to polarize the people who are victimized by it, the people who believe it, but to polarize the people who don't believe it, because they want them to feel like, well, it's just not worth talking to anybody on the other side. You know, we don't have to do it. And this is why you see the political model being used, one where, you know, people are shouting on both sides, whether they're shouting about values or beliefs. Well, now they're shouting about facts. I want to step back from that model for a minute. Think of a medical model. Medicine is very fact-based, but there's also an important values orientation to it. If you find a doctor who says, well, I'm kind of indifferent between health and disease, or I don't necessarily think that patient dying is a bad thing, you'd be appalled, right? Those are just not the values of medicine. But they're still fact-based. Now, in performing their experiments, this is why they have double-blind controlled experiments, because they want to make sure that their own interests, their own subjective values, are not getting in the way of discovering the truth. And so it is important to have objectivity even when you have a normative orientation. You know, you think that health is better than disease, you think life is better than death, etc. But imagine that you were a physician or medical researcher, you know, who made a breakthrough discovery, and, you know, you understood finally the relationship between, say, cigarette smoking and cancer. You might write about it in a way that was advocacy. You might find yourself saying, you know, yes, I'm a scientist, but I'm not dispassionate about this. If you want to be healthy, quit smoking. So that's advocacy, but it's not partisan. It's advocacy based on an understanding of the facts. Now, other people can dispute the facts, maybe because they're making money, like the cigarette companies were, or maybe because, you know, they're a smoker and they want to deny that it could be harming them, and they were the victims of the disinformation campaign. So maybe I overdid, really 24 times, maybe I overdid the war analogy too much. Maybe I should have developed this one about medicine. But it is with some passion that I approach this topic. Because like the physician saying, I'm indifferent between health and disease, I don't want to be the philosopher who says, I'm indifferent between the truth and a lie. I don't want to be the American who says, I'm indifferent between democracy and authoritarianism. I know what I believe in, and I think that the facts back me up.
Yeah, very well put. In chapter 3 of your book, you talk about the creators of disinformation. It has to start somewhere. And you use the terms fire hose of lies and whataboutism. Can you tell us a little bit about those tactics?
So those are old chestnuts. I don't know if those go all the way back to Dzerzhinsky and Lenin, but I think they do. I mean, those are really old disinformation tactics. And I would love to see a YouTube video that had Putin on one side and Trump on the other using them, you know, one example after another, because they do. Whataboutism is, you know, imagine someone who is confronted by an inconvenient truth and they don't want to talk about it. They will bring up something else. Imagine Putin being criticized for repression of dissidents in Russia. He might say, what about the homeless problem in the United States? Now, what do those two things have to do with one another? But if he keeps saying it, if he does it enough, maybe somebody will, you know, pick up on that. And Trump does it too. You know, whataboutism? This, and I go into it in the book a little bit. The other one, this has got to be my favorite, the fire hose of lies. The fire hose of lies is just the most insidious disinformation technique there is, because, and you'll love this, as the hosts of a podcast called Thinking Clearly, doesn't matter if you're inconsistent. With the fire hose of lies, you want to tell as many lies as possible in a short period of time, even if they contradict one another. Because the point isn't to convince your opponent that any one of those lies is true. It's to so overwhelm them with lying and maybe a truth thrown in now and then that they just give up. They say, I don't have 4 days to debunk that entire statement. I'll just, yeah, whatever you say, and they walk away. So the fire hose of lies, imagine, think again, mine goes back to Putin when he was accused of poisoning. I forget who it was. He's poisoned so many people, but he poisoned somebody. And his response was, well, you know, I heard that that was the Israelis and the person wasn't poisoned. And we heard that he had a kidney problem and that poison isn't even made in Russia. You hear Trump do it. You heard Trump do it when he was talking about January 6th. Those were peaceful protesters. And all the violence was committed by Antifa or Black Lives Matter in disguise. Now, how could those two things be true at the same time? There was no violence, but the violence was committed by false flag. Those are inconsistent, but that's the fire hose of lies.
Something that really strikes me about the fire hose of lies, too, because it draws a very vivid image, is a lot of the amplifiers of disinformation really use the tactic of the fire hose of lies. I think about the sort of meme factories that are online, but also other people who are repeating this disinformation. Our own local sheriff said that there's a bus of Antifa coming to the area.
Oh, yeah. That's a different tactic, by the way, the repetition effect. So the fire hose of lies is when you tell one different lie after another. The repetition effect is when you tell the same lie over and over. Every time, I mean, it's a branding thing. Every time you hear Trump say it's a hoax, it's a witch hunt, he does it over and over. He does it, you get sick of it. And then you go to his rallies and somebody's handwritten witch hunt on their sign. So, I mean, it gets through. The repetition effect is so powerful. I don't know why we don't use it more for truth. You know, every time Giuliani tells a lie, or Trump, you know, just mix it up here, talk about Giuliani for a minute. I saw how, you know, upset he was the other day over, you know, being charged, arraigned. And, you know, he was just saying, you know, the Department of Justice was weaponized and what a travesty this was, et cetera, et cetera. And the appropriate response might have been, or you committed a crime. And then he lies again. And you say, or you committed a crime. How many times would you have to say that before he'd finally think, ooh, you're good. Stop. Stop doing that. You're messing me up. But I mean, repeating the truth, I mean, to an intelligent person, repeating the truth sounds like such a blunt tactic. We don't want to do it because it just sounds idiotic. How many times does a smart person need to hear the truth and they believe it? You're done. That's not what it's about. It's about making sure that, you know, you're keeping up with the volume of repetition of falsehood. That's by the way, counterintelligence officials, army officials, that's one of the tools in their toolkit when they're fighting foreign disinformation, repetition.
Going back to the media again, I flagged this quote in your book. It goes like this: every media outlet constructs narratives. The problem is when you subvert the complexity of the facts to the dominant story you're telling. That's a real danger, and it happens all the time. When relevant facts are left out because they don't fit the narrative thrust of the story you're trying to tell. End quote. Talk about that in regard to journalists, and also in regard to us all, because I don't think it only applies to journalists. I think we all do that at times.
By the way, I don't think that was something I said. I think that was Chris Hayes from MSNBC. I think I was quoting Chris Hayes.
Okay.
And I don't have the book in front of me, so I don't know, but I think I was quoting him, and he's one of my favorite newscasters. And the fact that he said that, the fact that he realized, I mean, he was within that context of that interview was talking about the extent to which, well, you know, Fox News lies, but MSNBC can leave out the truth sometime to shape it toward the narrative that we know our listeners want to hear. And I wrestled with that because I thought, well, I don't want to blame the man for telling the truth. I mean, maybe the other newscasters are doing the same thing. They just don't want to admit the truth. And he was admitting it. He was saying that, you know, this was part of newscasting. It was having a narrative that you had to fit facts into. And sometimes the facts didn't fit the narrative and they got left on the cutting room floor. So I don't want to criticize him too much for admitting it. What I do want to talk about is the content of what he said. And I think he was right. Because media have their own interests. And I know they don't like to think of it that way, but not being accused of political bias, that's a, you know, pretty big interest. But money and engagement is a big interest as well. I don't know how many people know this. The big cable news outlets get their Nielsen ratings on a minute-by-minute basis. I'm old enough to remember the Nielsen overnight ratings. They're not overnight anymore. They're minute-by-minute. Now, I don't think they get them in real time, minute-by-minute, you know, where the producer can say, cut. But the next day, they can go back through their program and know, that story killed us. We're not doing that story again. Or you spent way too long on this. Or why don't you amp that up? I mean, just look at Fox. Do you think that comes out of nowhere? They're obsessed with their minute-by-minutes at Fox. They're called the minute-by-minutes. They cost a lot. That's the most expensive product through Nielsen. But it tells them in real time what their viewers were engaged with, when they went to commercial, when, you know, it got bumped up, presumably because they went on Twitter and said, oh, you got to see what Hannity's saying right now. That can really shape coverage. And again, Soledad O'Brien, she knows it shapes it at all the networks. Look, I don't want to draw false equivalence here myself. Shaping a narrative is not good, but it's not lying. I mean, when the Dominion lawsuit came out and, you know, we understood that Fox News hosts were saying things on air that they knew to be a lie in order to goose their ratings, that's much, much, much worse than the thing that Chris Hayes is talking about. But it's still not good.
And having a narrative has long been the game that's played in journalism and news. I had the ability to get involved in doing a little news as a community journalist, KMUD, our local community radio station. I had a problem because when I was interviewing, rather than think, what's the hook, what's the story, what's the angle, and then shaping my questions in that direction, I would ask questions as if I really didn't know anything about the subject and I really wanted to know about it. Mm. And I had to get those down to 10 minutes or whatever. I'd have half an hour or 40 minutes of interview. And I actually quit doing that because it got to be such a job and agonize over what should I leave in, what should I take out, what's really the truth here. I realized it's not cut out for doing a journalism where you have small sound bites that you're actually trying to develop a narrative. So I do understand that. But when you combine the narratives with a true polarization and politicization, catering to just a certain faction of people, beliefs, and worldviews, that is what makes it treacherous.
It does, because the thing that you just described there, without using the word that we all know, confirmation bias, when, you know, you're looking for the facts to hang as ornaments on a tree that you've already got. That's when you realize, say, if you're a scientist, you're not going to get to the truth. Because what you got to do to test a theory is to try to find facts that don't fit the narrative. And if you find fact that doesn't fit the narrative, then you change the narrative. So it really depends on what your goal is. Is your goal to know the truth, or is your goal to tell a story that keeps readers engaged? Can you do both? That's the challenge for good journalism, to try to do both. In hearing you describe your earlier experience, I mean, you're on the side of the angels there, I think, in the approach that you were taking, because you're curious. You want to learn something. You're not just advocating for a point of view. You want to find out how it works. And I've asked myself, would I have written a book like On Disinformation if I hadn't already written three prior ones in which I had the foundational, you know, the theory there? MIT Press is a wonderful fit for me because although my books are trade books, they're not afraid of footnotes. They're happy to have me put 30 pages of footnotes in my previous book, not the new one, but in my previous book, so that people could, you know, look it up so that it's clear. No, I've got the receipts, you know, here it is. And so, you know, without that platform to build on, I might not have felt so brave to go ahead and write something that was a, you know, more advocacy book. And I'll tell you the truth, I'm not sure I'll do it again. I think this is my advocacy book. I think this is the one. After this, I'm going to do something else because it's either going to work or I'll be a dissident in my own country. I mean, really, I think that those are the stake. Look what happens to intellectuals who speak out in countries that go authoritarian, Hungary, Turkey. It's not good.
It's definitely some very serious matters on our hands. So I do appreciate that you wrote the book, and maybe we consider essays or something like that in the future. Just throw that out there.
Oh, what's haiku? Something else. something else. I'd really, to tell you the truth, I've got a philosophical topic that I've been itching to get back to, but the world has been on fire and I haven't had a chance to get back to it. But I know exactly what I want to do next, and it's a philosophical topic.
We're all looking forward to it, I'm sure. Well, in this book on disinformation, you talk about many things we've talked about here. It's a little bit more of an advocacy book about making things better through policy changes, things that are really relevant, restoring the fairness doctrine, which, of course, started with radio, something I felt very passionately about for at least 15 years, which is revising Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that has absolutely shaped the face of the internet. Even though the internet's international, and this is a national law, it has absolutely established what the internet is today, as well as putting various pressures on other platforms like social media companies. Maybe you could share some of those ideas with us, because I'm sure it's something that has at least crossed all of our minds on occasions.
Yeah. I wish there were some one thing that we could do to fix this problem. And in the book, I speculate about a few of the things that got us here and a few of the things that people have talked about. You know, well, what if we brought back the fairness doctrine? You know, that seemed to have kicked off the whole partisan media craze. But then you realize that the fairness doctrine only really was there because it was for broadcast media. And now we have private media, you know, so it wouldn't even necessarily apply to them. So how would it work? You couldn't just rescind that law and bring things back the way it was. You'd have to think of something else. I mean, I love the idea of the fairness doctrine because what it does is it recognizes that balance within media is much more valuable than balance across media, because people don't listen to a diversity of sources. They listen to one or two. And if those are partisan, then they're just in a silo and there's nothing you can do to break them out of it. So, I mean, I love the idea of, you know, trying to have more balance within media. So that's one idea that I explore in that book. Section 230, I mean, I'm right there with you. Because what people forget, I mean, Section 230 was this part of the Communications Decency Act that shielded the internet companies from being sued for the content on their platforms, because somebody else said it, not them. They were just providing a platform. Now, what people forget about Section 230 is that there are two parts of it. One, it protects the social media companies from being sued if they leave something up that was libelous or slanderous or false or whatever it is. But it also protects them if they take something down because they don't like it, for whatever the reason might be. I mean, all the people who are confused between fighting disinformation and censorship should remember that. We're talking about private companies. The First Amendment protects you from censorship from government, not private companies. They can take down anything they want on Twitter and Facebook, and you have no grounds to do anything other than quit the platform because they're also protected by Section 230. Now, here's the issue as I see it. For some reason, the social media companies have convinced us that, oh, but if we tinker with Section 230, it would be the downfall of the internet. I mean, how could we possibly have an internet changing the law? Well, I don't know. We have libel laws in newspapers, TV, public speech, just about any other thing except social media. So how they've performed this magic trick of making us think that they're the one media outlet that has to be, you know, protected, when they're actually, you know, over half of people get their news now from social media. I mean, it's just, it's mystifying to me. And I'm not arguing here in favor of changing the libel laws or the Congress decide, you know, being the ultimate fact checker. I think what I'd settle for is more transparency. Right now, the social media companies have these algorithms that are, I think, tweaked up high for engagement. And they can change that, but they don't have much interest in doing it, and nobody knows what they're up to. So imagine a world in which the United States Congress said, look, we don't want to be the fact checker in chief, but we do want you to open your algorithms to a panel of experts who are from universities, you know know what they're looking at, and we're going to shield all user data, and it's all going to be blind. But we're tired of waiting for whistleblowers to come forward 2 years later and tell us that there was public harm. We want somebody looking at this, just like we regulate the car industry, just like we regulate the food industry. We're going to start to regulate, more transparency for social media. They could do that. And again, they've created this magic trick where we all think that somehow, this is the one industry that couldn't possibly be regulated.
Well, and it is happening in other countries. They can successfully do it and meet the laws of other countries. I mean, Germany's very kind of famous for that, having very restrictive laws. I try not to be too self-promoting or self-referential in this program, but it is reminding me of a show we did back in 2021, The Attention Economy, with Michael Goldhaber, which it really kind of describes a lot of what you're talking about, how we are literally paying these companies with our attention, and it's what drives them to have these even more kind of sensational headlines to attract our attention, because we only have 24 hours in a day and so many clicks in my finger.
That's how we pay them. I'm glad you brought up the international picture there, because I want to just put on this brief codicil here, which is that you do find some countries saying, we absolutely agree with you and we're fighting disinformation on the internet. Careful. Because sometimes what they're doing is censoring their enemies, China, Russia, Turkey, these countries that have passed laws outlawing, lying in public, 10-year sentence if you lie. They're not doing that because they care so much about the truth. They're doing that because it's a convenient way of repression.
Talking about these issues and regulating what is said and shown on social media, get into the question of free speech. So when we start pushing the companies to moderate communication on social media, even though we're targeting disinformation, we get pushback from people saying we're stifling free speech. Now, in your book, you make the point that whereas free speech is a guaranteed right, that amplifying that speech is not. It seems to be a core issue you're trying to get across to us.
Yes.
Can you develop that argument for us?
Yeah, you put your finger on it in exactly the right way there. Even if you were a radical free speech advocate and you thought that even the most heinous speech deserved not to be censored, that does not mean that every single person deserves a microphone to reach a worldwide audience instantaneously for whatever they have to say. The analogy I use in the book is, suppose you were a radical free speech advocate and you thought that even though you hated their message, we had to give a parade permit to the Ku Klux Klan to have their rally. That's one thing. Does that require you to go to the rally and help them hand out flyers? It does not. That's amplification. So I've seen an awful lot of cheap talk these days about people who are conflating fighting disinformation with censorship, because they don't understand that distinction about amplification. Refusing to amplify someone else's lie is not censoring them. They've got as much ability as anyone else to say whatever lie they want. It just doesn't have to be on your program. Twitter could do that overnight. Facebook could do that overnight. They often choose not to.
So you've described yourself as a public philosopher. What does that mean?
I've embraced the term. When I started to do this, there wasn't a term for it. I mean, there had been public philosophers back to Socrates. I became a public philosopher when I realized that I wanted to write for an audience that was larger than just the 20 other scholars who I already knew on a first name basis, who worked in my subdiscipline. because I wanted to embrace bigger public issues. I mean, all of a sudden, truth and belief and lying was in the media. I mean, if a philosopher can't get excited about that, I mean, we've been waiting for years to have a moment when anybody cared what we thought about truth. And here we are. And so, as I said, I've been writing on this stuff roughly since 1996 and interested in bringing philosophy to a larger audience. So public philosophy can be thought of as where you write about it so clearly that a public audience would get interested in what philosophers are already interested in. But I think a more expansive definition is that you allow philosophy to accommodate the issues of your time that matter, that other people are already interested in, and you get some philosophical attention to that. So I think both are legitimate ways of doing public philosophy. And in the last 10 years, public philosophy has taken off. Public philosophy is cool. I mean, I've been doing it before it was cool. But what happened was I was ready, because when public philosophy came along, I was at an APA convention, American Philosophical Association. And one of the questions that I love to ask a group of editors, you know, when they're sitting around, is, what kind of book has nobody written that you wish somebody would write? And that's not because I'm going to write anything they tell me, but just, you know, hear what they have to say. And one of the editors said, I would love a companion volume on public philosophy. It's time. And I thought, oh boy. And so I immediately contacted two friends of mine, and we edited the first edited volume, The Blackwell Companion to Public Philosophy, which I highly recommend. It's one of the few books I've done in the last 10 years that's not with MIT Press. But that volume brings together, I think it's 40-something of the, you know, leading scholars, not all philosophy professors, people who philosophy in prison, people, you know, who are activists. I mean, public philosophy to me is a return to its roots. Public philosophy is what Socrates was doing. He'd go to the Agora and talk to people and question their beliefs and got in a lot of trouble for it. 1,000 years later, philosophy got taken over by the academics and they never loosened their grip on it. Well, now it's kind of back. Now it's not just in the grips of the academics. And I think that's good, because even though I have traditional philosophical credentials, I have a PhD and I was a professor for a long time, and I love doing the scholarship that I was trained to do, I also want to do the stuff where I can engage the general public. That's really meaningful to me.
Well, here at Thinking Clearly, we are glad there is such thing as public philosopher and public philosophy, because it engages us. And that's a wonderful thing. So we're getting a little short on time, but I wanted to get to this in the last chapter of Disinformation. The last chapter is titled How to Win the War on Truth. And we've talked about some of this, but you give some suggestions as to what we can all do to help clean up our information environment. So briefly talk about those ideas, including content rebuttal, technique rebuttal, and pre-bunking.
There was a brilliant study in Nature Human Behavior in 2019 by Cornelia Bache and Philip Schmid, which provided the first empirical evidence to show that you could change people's minds, science deniers' minds, by debunking what they said. Now, one way was through content rebuttal, which may come as a shock to people. Sometimes facts work. I mean, if you're an expert in those facts, there are situations in which you actually can change somebody's mind with facts, and they showed this empirically. The other way was technique rebuttal, which is when you understand, and this is subtle, not just what they believe, but why they believe it. What is the logic of science denial? Well, they cherry pick facts. They engage in conspiracy theories. They engage in illogical reasoning. They rely on fake experts. But once you understand that, then you can challenge their beliefs, not by saying, well, that belief is wrong, but by saying, why do you believe that? Or isn't that inconsistent with what you said before? Or my favorite technique rebuttal question, what evidence could prove you wrong? Is there anything I could say, you know, if I had it in my back pocket, I could show it to you, that would make you change your mind? And then my favorite of all is pre-bunking. Because if debunking is powerful, pre-bunking is even more powerful. Because remember, we talked about the fire hose of falsehood and whataboutism and the repetition effect. There's another cognitive bias called the primacy effect, primacy effect is that whatever you hear first, you're more likely to believe it. That's why the truth sandwich works, by the way. You don't want to say the lie first because then they're more likely to believe it. You want to say the truth first. Primacy effect works for both truth and a lie, which means that if you can get to people before they hear the disinformation, then you've got a better chance. So don't wait for them to hear it and be victimized and then debunk it, because people hate to change their mind. Mark Twain said, it's easier to fool somebody than to convince them that they've been fooled. Instead, go in with your truth before and say, this next speaker, he's going to present a conspiracy theory, and he's really slick, and you're going to think that there's something to it, and it's going to sound like a lot of evidence, but it's really not. It's a conspiracy theory. Here's how you can tell. And then, you know, give them the fingerprints of a conspiracy theory. And then when they hear it, they'll go, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, no, I never would have believed that. Yeah, yes, you would, but you were pre-bunked.
Good wrap up to wrap up this edition of Thinking Clearly. Just real quickly now, you gave us a little teaser that you're tackling a new philosophical subject or area. You want to tell us what that is?
I'll tell you, but you're not going to like it. The pragmatic vindication of warranted belief. It is an expansion on a footnote in my 2019 book, The Scientific Attitude. I stumbled on something that I think is a philosophical discovery that expands on some work that was done in the 1940s and 50s with induction. And I'm interested in whether it also works for warranted belief. And so that's what I'm going to write a philosophical paper on this and try to get it published in a peer-reviewed journal. Told you weren't going to like it.
That sounds exciting.
If we had another hour, I could explain it, because I really think that this notion is key to understanding how science works. But I've got to do the foundation work first, the philosophical work. I got to build my structure, and then I'll bring it out in the public and talk about why it's important. And I'm going to come on your show for the fourth time about that.
All right. You heard it here, folks. We're going to hold him to it, too. So we will be looking forward to that. So, Professor Lee McIntyre, thank you very much for tackling this set of ideas. It's so crucial to us all. And for providing a provisional map for how we can take action to help move us to better times. So on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your books and your personal author page. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
Personal author page, LeeMcIntyreBooks.com. That's the one.
Got it. A big thanks to our listeners. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.